Thank you for joining us today to learn more about Dr. King, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate and architect of the nonviolent civil rights movement. Considered by many to be one of the greatest orators in U.S. history, Dr. King also authored several books, including Stride Toward Freedom, The Montgomery Story, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, and Why We Can't Wait. His speeches, sermons, and writings are inspirational and timeless. His words of peace and justice are all the more poignant, knowing that he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. Dr. King was just 49 years old. Today we're taking a different look at Dr. King. We'll be speaking with some community members who agreed to share their thoughts about the civil rights movement and Dr. King's legacy. We'll hear from one of WTIP's longtime volunteers, Tyler Howell, whose parents, especially his mother who grew up in the Deep South, felt firsthand the discrimination that Dr. King fought so hard to end. Pastor Dale McIntyre of Cornerstone Community Church in Grand Marais will share a child's eye view of desegregation. We'll talk with Diane Anderson of Hovland about a church youth trip to hear Dr. King speak in 1961. We'll have some special music and a reading of some of Dr. King's words. Thanks again for tuning in to this special edition of the North Shore News Hour, dedicated to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who, if he were still with us, would have been 90 years old this year. Joining us now is one of our Cook County resident and one of our wonderful WTIP volunteers, Tyler Howell. Thanks for coming in, Tyler.
Good afternoon, Rhonda. It's certainly my pleasure.
All right. And now I've worked with you for a while here at the station, known you for quite a while, but I realize I don't know that much about your background. Can you kind of fill us in a little bit?
Let me share. I was born and raised in the Twin Cities. Both of my parents worked as hard as they could, or the best they could, to provide good opportunities for me. Well-educated, had a chance to travel, career selection, and my mother was from the South, which kind of impacts this, too, because she had many stories to tell, and my father was in the service, and he had stories to tell about the efforts that Dr. King put forth to try to correct some of the wrongs that were going on in our country at that time.
All right. So where was your mom from?
My mom was from Biloxi, Mississippi.
Oh, okay.
And perhaps a story that might be of some interest is that she was the oldest of eight children. She went to nursing school. She went from Biloxi to Jackson, Mississippi for her nurse's training. And every year the school gave out a $100 check and a diploma for the best student. My mother was the best student, the valedictorian of her class. She got the diploma. And it was a mixed class of white and black students, and she got the diploma that year and did not get the $100 check.
How was that explained to her?
She understood. Having grown up in Mississippi, she knew the background. She challenged it, and we're doing things differently this year is the response that she got.
Oh, man. Wow.
I was raised in the Catholic Church, as she was, and when she was in Jackson, she went around looking for a church to attend. One of the holiest people that I know, devout Catholics that I know, she went up to a nun that was sweeping the sidewalks and asked the nun what time the services were at the Catholic Church. And the nun says, "I don't know what time the services are at the black church down the road there." So she did get information, but not quite the information that she wanted to.
It's so hard to imagine that people were like that. How was your mom now then? And because then she must have met your father and you guys ended up in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Was your mom bitter about this?
I think she just understood and was going to move forward. I saw some occasional anger from my father, but he also had many incidents in his lives that he had to reflect on, and he shared those with us as an educational opportunity, learning opportunity, and we did learn from them. Okay. I carry those with me even today.
Can you give us an example of something he shared with you?
My dad was in the service, and he was in an all-black platoon. He was the sergeant, and he remembered transferring from one location to the other. I'm not quite sure where he was going or where he was coming from, but they had segregated train cars in those days. My dad was in one of the train cars, and there was just another old black woman in there with him. And all of the white soldiers that knew my dad, knew of him, were in another car, jammed in, packed in with each other. And just the two of them in the back car, in the back of the bus, of course. And this woman had brought fried chicken and pie and things like that. She was sharing it with my dad. And these guys were all stuffed up in the front. They wanted to come back, too. But the conductor denied them access.
That's the way it was.
Even if it was good for our soldiers, even if it was good for our country, It was still denied and frowned upon in those days.
We have made some progress in the world.
We have made a lot of progress.
When we hear things like this.
This is true. But I am seeing some scary things happening this day and age.
Yeah. So now your folks, what did they think of Dr. King?
They tried to explain to us what he was doing, why he was doing it. We had grown up in South Minneapolis, went to a private Catholic school, somewhat insulated from the difficulties of the South and other parts of the country. But at the same time, some of this stuff leaked in. And so they made many efforts to use them as learning opportunities and explain to us what was going on, why it was going on, to see some of the marches, to see some of the riots as a result of that, to see some of the opposition that he got from certain counties and certain countries was very frightening to me. I was in grade school and junior high school at the time. I was in junior high when he died. And as I said, I was afraid to go out. There had been some unrest in the Twin Cities as well. And to see that going on, to hear about it, to read about it in the paper, was quite disconcerting. And so I mentioned to you before we did this that it's a very emotional time for me, and I have difficulty going back there. I hadn't received a lot of discrimination, but the ones that were painful.
Yeah.
The ones that were painful, even in a Catholic school.
Okay. Do you want to share one?
Playing on the playground and enjoying the afternoon and hanging out with some of my peeps. And one guy came up and spit right in my face for no particular reason. I was just a little third grader, had no particular reason whatsoever. But I had been met after school a number of times by bullies and challenged right there. I remember getting in a tussle with one of the guys and he went home with the black eye and the split lip that time. So the word got out. The word got out that it took a lot to get me fired up, a lot to get me excited. But if it happened, watch yourself.
Oh, my. So, and I hope, though, because you said you were, for the most part, I mean, those are some horrible incidents, especially to imagine a young Tyler going through that. But for the most part, have you felt equality? Have you felt that things are different?
I would say I had to go after what I wanted. My parents prepared me. Martin Luther King paved the way. I don't know if you've ever seen my Facebook page, but every once in a while I'll come out with a statement of a black woman or a black man, children, white women out in the society, and I'll say standing on the shoulders of giants. These are the people that pave the way. These are the people that sacrifice their time and their energy, use their knowledge to make it possible for me to live in Grand Marais in paradise, to travel the world like I have, to obtain the education that I did. And also, I had a very successful career because of these opportunities that were paved for me.
Well, as I mentioned, Dr. King would have been 90 this year if he was still with us. What are your thoughts, Tyler, now as more of a grown-up about Dr. King and his legacy?
Well, I've had this thought every year as this comes around, this day comes in. I suspect Dr. King would be rolling in his grave, spinning right now because people are out of work, out of school, and he worked so hard to provide working opportunities for persons of color. He worked so hard to provide equal education opportunities for them. And perhaps we can spend our time just a little bit better in strategy meetings or doing something for the poor or doing for the people in need. Right now, there's a lot of people in need that may need some assistance.
Absolutely. One more thing that you talked about standing up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What about Dr. King's message of civil disobedience? Because he was a very nonviolent person. He was a pastor
mm-hmm.
and really had a strong Christian background, and peace was very important to him. Do you think that's something we should also?
Absolutely. If we can turn the other cheek, it says it in the Bible. Give some patience, give some tolerance. Walk away if you can, but there are some times when you have to stand firm. You have to stand your ground.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for, I've been speaking with Tyler Howell, one of our WTIP volunteers, about his memories of the era of Dr. King. We're about the same age, Tyler.
Oh,
I remember. I was in school, remember watching the riots and the programs, and of course, the assassination. Do you remember how that impacted your family?
My mother just came to me and said, be careful, because there's going to be backlashes here. And sure enough, there was some vandalism and rioting in the streets. There were scare tactics that went on. And so I made a point of traveling to my job as directly as possible, to coming and going, to taking care of business and coming back home again.
Wow.
And it was one of those things that I was thinking about it coming out here. That Martin Luther King was kind of like Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jimi Hendrix. I really didn't appreciate them until after they were gone. It was the writings of others and people sharing the information about them that I learned what an impact they had on my life. And not just mine, not just the persons of color in this country, but also Jewish people and women and gay and lesbians. He fought for the rights of all people. He fought for the rights of all people.
Well, thank you so much, Tyler. And one more question.
Okay.
You kind of touched on this earlier a little bit about it's kind of concerning. Of late, it seems like there's been kind of a resurgent of oppressive efforts. There's, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. What do you think, what would you say to those folks? Maybe, I mean, how can we revive Dr. King's message?
I guess walk the way you talk is the important thing. When I deal with everybody here, treat them with respect. Go out of my way to help people that might be in need. Hold the door at the YMC, I think. Greeting the men and women over the air here at WTIP, trying to give them their due. I got challenged on the number of women that performed on WTIP's Boomer Jam one night. I went through and counted them out, and sure enough, there was about 50% were women performers and 50% were men. So make sure that the artists that get recognized, and I'll get some criticism too, follow all aspects of life here, all genres.
Thanks again, Tyler, for talking to us today. Anything that you want to add?
It is paradise here, but there are things that we can do to make it better. There are things we can do to make it better. There are still some difficulties out there, and everybody walks the way they talk. I think that this will be a better place.
All right. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you, Rhonda. It's certainly been a pleasure.
Next, we'll hear a powerful piece of music from the civil rights era, penned by Nina Simone. Her 1965 song, Mississippi Goddamn, which blatantly denounced the rampant racism in the South, called for equality in terms everyone and anyone could understand. There may be some listeners who are offended. That was definitely the case in 1965. The backlash was fast and furious. The song was banned in several states. In an interview with National Public Radio, Simone's daughter Lisa described how boxes of the records would return from radio stations around the country, cracked in half. Simone's career never fully recovered, but the show went on. On March 25, 1965, Simone performed her song before tens of thousands of marchers in Selma on a stage propped up by coffins. Here's Nina Simone.
Mississippi Goddamn is our last tune. We had some requests for it. I Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Governor Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on the land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know they keep on saying, go slow. That's just the trouble.
Do so.
Washing the windows.
Do so.
Picking the cotton.
Do so.
We're just plain rotten.
Do so.
We're too damn lazy.
Do so.
I'm thinking it's crazy.
Do so.
Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do my very best. Try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. You lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. My country is full of lies. We are all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. They keep on saying go slow. That's just the trouble.
So.
Desegregation.
So.
Mass participation.
So.
Unification.
So.
Do things gradually.
Joining us in the studio now is Diane Anderson of Hovland, someone from the North Shore who had the opportunity to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak when she was a young woman. Thanks for agreeing to share your story with us, Diane.
You're welcome.
All right. So first, tell us when and where it was that you heard Dr. King speak.
I was in Miami Beach in 1961 at a youth gathering, and he was the main speaker there.
All right. And this was a national church gathering, or how
it was? It was probably the first and the biggest national gathering of the Lutherans, the American Lutheran Church, young people in the United States. There were 14,000 people, which was a high number at the time, 14,000 youth. I think that the numbers have totally, they're much higher today, but for then, that was a large gathering.
Well, it's certainly a large gathering for a young woman from northeastern Minnesota. So how did this come about? Who decided to travel from our little corner of the world to the segregated South during the 1960s?
The pastor at the time was Joel Anderson, and he had...
Any relation?
No relation. Okay. He was in charge of the youth group, which was called Luther League at the time, and we would go together. That would be the Trinity Youth and the Bethlehem Youth. He decided that this would be a thing that we should do. He was a very good, forward-thinking person, and he decided that, and I couldn't afford to go. There were two of us from Hovland who did go, but I, at the very last minute, the Lutheran women at Trinity came forward and gave us both some money towards our trip.
Oh, that's great.
So I was glad to go.
Yes. Yeah. So who, you mentioned someone else from Hovland. Who was that?
It was Mary Beth Strand. She's probably known mostly as Mary Beth Doucette. She has since passed away.
She has, yeah. And were there other folks from Cook County that went?
There were. I remember Jim Johnson and Bev Olson at the time, who married Jim. And I think Rena Stone Carlson was there.
Okay.
Maybe Ginger Beckman. I'm not sure. And thinking, let's see, Norman Moe.
Norman Moe, who folks know as our sports broadcaster here on the station. Wow.
And Tom Tofty.
Okay.
Whose parents had the newspaper here for a while.
Mm-hmm. Wow. A fairly large group then. Who chaperoned the trip? I'm guessing the pastor.
The pastor and his wife, Louise.
Okay. And that was it?
That was it.
Okay. And in addition to this trip and the pastor who got you guys to go and so forth, you mentioned to me earlier about another community leader who kind of influenced your thoughts on the whole matter of race relations and tolerance and so forth. Tell me about that.
There was a teacher, a high school teacher named Lee Thomas, that was very good. In fact, I believe my class suggested that he be our class pick for the year when we graduated. But he actually was well aware of intolerance. I do believe in later years, after I had left school, not much later, he had the students buy a book called The Social Setting of Intolerance, which wasn't just about, I don't think it had much to do with Black people, but it had to do with the setting of intolerance. And I never got to be in his class when he was teaching that. I wish I had. That would have added to, but those students who were able to read it probably learned a lot.
All right. And you feel that you learned a lot from him?
I did. He made us aware of things going on in the world. And sometimes he caused maybe other people to think a little differently too. And I think that was great.
And how'd you travel down to Miami?
We took a train out of the cities. Our train was called the Gold Train. There were two trainloads of Luther Leaguers. Others went by bus and by car, I suppose. I don't think anyone necessarily flew, but they may have. The two trains were the biggest part of it, and we were the only train, of course, that lost our air conditioning.
Oh, no. Oh, the Northerners. Great.
Right. Yes. It was horrible in that respect, but you could get out on the platform and cool down from time to time.
Oh, my gosh. And so was the whole train youths from the various churches in the country, or was it a mix of passengers?
No, it was the youth. We had two Luther League trains.
Well, that's neat. So you got to meet other kids from around the country.
I certainly did. I actually looked up my cousins from Wisconsin. They had different blocks of states. And so I remember looking at my cousins and thinking that was pretty neat too.
Absolutely, yes. So traveling by train, and then to get to, where Dr. King spoke, was it a big auditorium or outdoors? Or
it was an auditorium, I'm guessing a convention center in Miami Beach.
Okay. And any controversy around, well, we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, but just physical safety going to the conference and to the speech. Were you ever concerned for your safety?
No. It was a tourist area. It was in Miami Beach, and we went to the shops and things. And I guess the thing that was said was that Christ is living. It was like our theme, and it was kind of interesting because it was in a Jewish area, So they have a different take on that, of course.
Right. Some irony there.
So we had a lot of questions as young Luther Leaguers. They had fun talking to us.
Oh, definitely. Okay. But nothing controversial. It was
no,
a nice,
I felt
peaceful.
Safe.
Good. Okay. And so what do you remember most about the speech?
The most I remember is that I was just taken away by his passion, by the fact that he would see in us, the youth, we were so young, that the future, the hope for the Black people could be through us as well. And he pretty much laid it out for us that we would be able to help bring about some of the change that was necessary. And all of that, I've never forgotten, because it does change your life. And events that happened after that, too, that were related to Dr. King, are part of my life as well.
Yeah. When you were in the auditorium, because it sounds like if it was, you know, a convention center or something, that's a lot of people, but you still felt connected? It sounds like you still...
It was a message, and as a young person, it was a message somebody had never said to me before. And it made me realize that youth do have power. We do have to help make changes in the world.
All right. You know, this makes me think of something you said, because, yeah, we're up here in northern Minnesota, where segregation wasn't an official thing. So maybe perhaps it wasn't talked about very much in our community. What did your parents think of you going on this trip?
They knew I really wanted to go. And I'm glad that somehow I found a way to go. They always wanted us to have the opportunities. Any extra little thing for them cost a bit, you know. And at the time, we didn't really think we could afford it. I was fortunate that the ladies of the church came forward and gave some help.
That is such a blessing. So, and now you told me before we went on air that in recent years you learned that there was some controversy among the church leaders about having Dr. King speak. Tell me about that.
I researched. I didn't realize that Dr. King had actually rescinded because he thought it would cause too much controversy in the church, and therefore he wasn't going to be there, because I suppose he'd heard that the presidents had thought it was not a good idea. Because the church leaders were called presidents at the time of the American Lutheran Church, and they weren't called bishops as they are today. Their concern was that it would cause division in the church, whether or not it was a good thing for us to hear. Mm-hmm. And many of them thought that we were maybe too young to catch on to what it was that Dr. Martin Luther King was saying. One thing that I did find out was that the John Birch Society had sent letters saying that this should not happen.
Wow.
And they had made the decision then, as the presidents, not to do this. But the youth board in Minneapolis decided it was still a good idea and pursued it and got Dr. King to change his mind.
And they traveled to where Dr. King was?
Yes, and they said, I guess it was in Atlanta at the time, and they got him to come after all.
All right. So do you feel that's a blessing that he ended up? I mean, what would the trip have been like if Dr. King had not been the speaker?
If he had not been the speaker, I don't know who the speaker would have been. And I'm certainly hoping that it would have been someone decent and good. And I'm sure it would have been, but it wouldn't have been quite the same for me, because he was such a person of good intention and such a big part of the movement in America for equality, which I still feel is a movement. It wowed me as a young person, and it still does today.
That's great. And as a young person, though, you're on the train and you spent some time on the beach, I'm hoping.
A little bit.
Okay. And got to meet friends and so forth. So were you aware of all this political drama? Did you realize the significance of hearing Dr. King speak?
No, I didn't. What was significant to me was the impact it made for me. And then, of course, a lot of it came later in college years and all. His assassination was in 68, in April, and I was still at St. Olaf. And I remember my Black friends and others from the Tuskegee Exchange group marched on up St. Olaf Avenue to the Student Union and gave their take on what it had been like growing up Black in America. before that, before I heard Dr. Martin Luther King speak, too, I had read, I think his name is John Howard Griffin's book called Black Like Me. And of course, it was a white man's take on what it was like to be black because he changed the color of his skin. This was something I read in high school, and it made an impression on me, but still it was a white person's take on a black situation. And that made an impression, and then I heard Dr. Martin Luther King speak, and then my friends at college made an impression on me.
So, Diane, you mentioned at college at St. Olaf, you mentioned the Tuskegee Exchange. Tell me, what is that about?
Well, black students from the Tuskegee College could come to St. Olaf, and some of our St. Olaf students would go down to Tuskegee area and maybe teach or do something in the area, too. It was an opportunity for an exchange of cultures at the time and learning.
Okay, very good. Good for our Minnesota students to have that interaction and the folks from Tuskegee as well.
Except that there weren't just Minnesota residents because they might have been going to the college in Minnesota, but they were from all over too.
Oh, okay. But a good program.
It was. I also was, I worked in Chicago in 1967 before the rioting and before the death. It was the summer of 1967, I worked at the old Sears building as a catalog pricing clerk downtown. And there was a lot of unrest at the time, also not rioting or whatever, but I remember that on weekends, the National Guard was downtown. It wasn't like an assignment they had during, like they did during the rioting, but it was kind of to keep things in check, supposedly. So in that respect, I was a little afraid sometimes. I was a youth from Grand Marais, though, and I was so naive.
Yeah.
I remember getting the job at Sears and them asking me, how much money did you want? What would, do you think would be a fair wage? And I said what I thought would be a fair wage, and they gave me more.
Oh.
I had probably gone below what was allowed at the time, what the minimum wage was. But that's how naive I was. I probably still am.
Well, it certainly sounds like such a meaningful experience, and we are so happy that you shared it with us. I've been speaking with Diane Anderson of Hovland. And anything else, Diane, that you want to tell people about Dr. Martin Luther King?
Just that he speaks for a group of people, for the black people in America, but what he says is for all of us. There is so much discrimination these days, and it still exists. And people that are different deserve chances. We all deserve chances. And yes, I think his message is still a good one, and it will always be, for that matter.
All right. Thanks, Diane. And next, we'll hear a voice familiar to many of us.
Hello, my name is Dale McIntyre. I'm the pastor of Cornerstone Community Church in Grand Marais. I've lived in Grand Marais for 24 years, but I am not originally from Minnesota. I grew up in Columbus, Georgia, which is a town about 100 miles southwest of Atlanta and 100 miles directly east of Montgomery, Alabama. Growing up in the Deep South in the 1960s, I was in the fifth grade before I found out that black children went to school, let alone had a school of their own, which they did on the other side of the main street in our part of town. When I found out, it was suddenly, because one day in the fifth grade, all these black children appeared in class with us, and some of our teachers were gone, and new teachers, black teachers, were there in their places. That was also the time when Mom and Dad were cussing a lot about desegregation and busing and quotas and those damn politicians. And a lot of adults around me were yelling about that damn communist Martin Luther King Jr. who was out to destroy America. And I, for one, didn't understand. These were the same kids we played with at the park and at the boys' club. I just thought they were finally getting to come to school. Before that, I thought they just hung out and played until we got out of school each day. I was bused for high school from my neighborhood to what had been the only high school for black students in our Georgia county. We learned something more than just academics at Spencer High School. We learned about history and about tradition and about community. And we learned these lessons in the context of loss, as the black community in Columbus felt the loss of their school and their history and their traditions in a very unique way. The uproar came from both white and black students when, in my senior year, the principal announced that the graduating class would neither sway during their entrance and exit march, nor would they be allowed to march to the War March of the Priests. Now, that was the anthem that Spencer graduating seniors had marched to for decades, from the earliest days when the school district finally provided a high school for the black community. Instead, we were merely to walk into pomp and circumstance. It was a decision meant to appease the white parents at Fort Benning who had helped finance the building of the new school that we were in that year. Now, according to most of the rest of us, the new Army brats were delighted at the decision. But the rest of us who had spent 4 years learning why some tradition has deep meaning in some communities were devastated. We had been looking forward to the uniqueness of this. And we were especially devastated because the principal that year was a black man himself and an alumnus of a historically African-American high school. Class meetings with the principal met with very solid resistance from the administration. A group of us promised that we would stage a Martin Luther King Jr. protest march and would invite everyone we could find to come. That didn't work. So we challenged the principal with a different Dr. King principle: civil disobedience. Every senior class graduation rehearsal, as the organist played Pomp and Circumstance, the senior class would enter with a two-step sway march in halftime. Now, fortunately, Pomp and Circumstance and the War March of the Priests have the same meter, but not the same tempo. Anything, however, can be slowed down if you've got rhythm. It didn't matter what the principal threatened us with. All 180 of us marched exactly the same every time. Now, not everyone in the class agreed, and not everyone liked what we were doing, but everyone acted for the sake of those class members for whom that graduation had special historical significance. Finally, a week before graduation, late May of 1979, the principal called a class meeting and required all of the seniors to be present. At that meeting, he extended us an olive branch. The entrance and the exit marches, as they had been done historically, were simply adding too much time to the graduation ceremony as the senior classes got bigger. He offered to allow us to exit with the two-step sway march to the War March of the Priest if we would enter by a quick march to Pomp and Circumstance. In that moment, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., long dead by that time by an assassin's bullet, won a battle where black people and white people reached a mutually satisfying, emotionally supportive compromise that released all of us to appreciate the best that two cultures had to offer. Significantly, 10 years before that time in Columbus, when an all-white high school in our part of town was forced to accept desegregation, there were riots, blood was spilled, people were hurt. But, however slowly, the world can and does change, sometimes for the better, as the 1979 graduating class of Spencer High School in Columbus, Georgia, demonstrated.
Now, just in case you didn't recognize that music, that is the War March of the Priests. Thank you for sharing that memory, Pastor Dale. In August 1967, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King addressed his colleagues of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He spoke of the formation of the conference 10 years earlier, shortly after the year-long bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. He recalled that the conference started on a bitterly cold January day when a group of approximately 100 black leaders from across the South agreed on the need for an organization to serve as a channel through which local protest organizations in the South could coordinate activities. Dr. King spoke of the challenges overcome and the challenges yet to come. Sharing an excerpt from the speech now is WTIP Community Radio Board member and volunteer Mike Reeves.
When our organization was formed 10 years ago, racial segregation was still a structured part of the architecture of Southern society. Negroes, with the pangs of hunger and the anguish of thirst, were denied access to the average lunch counter. The downtown restaurants were still off limits for the black man. Negroes, burdened with the fatigue of travel, were still barred from the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. Negro boys and girls in dire need of recreational activities were not allowed to inhale the fresh air of the big city parks. Negroes in desperate need of allowing their mental buckets to sink deep into the wells of knowledge were confronted with a firm no when they sought to use the city libraries. 10 years ago, legislative halls of the South were still ringing loud with such words as interposition and nullification. All types of conniving methods were still being used to keep the Negro from becoming a registered voter. A decade ago, not a single Negro entered the legislative chambers of the South, except as a porter or a chauffeur. 10 years ago, all too many Negroes were still harried by day and haunted by night, by a corroding sense of fear and a nagging sense of nobodiness. But things are different now. In assault after assault, we caused the sagging walls of segregation to come tumbling down. During this era, the entire edifice of segregation was profoundly shaken. This is an accomplishment whose consequences are deeply felt by every Southern Negro in his daily life. It is no longer possible to count the number of public establishments that are open to Negroes. 10 years ago, Negroes seemed almost invisible to the larger society, and the facts of their harsh lives were unknown to the majority of the nation. But today, civil rights is a dominating issue in every state, crowding the pages of the press and the daily conversation of white Americans. In this decade of change, the Negro stood up and confronted his oppressor. He faced the bullies and the guns and the dogs and the tear gas. He put himself squarely before the vicious mobs and moved with strength and dignity toward them and decisively defeated them. We made our government write new laws to alter some of the cruelest injustices that affected us. We made an indifferent and unconcerned nation rise from lethargy and subpoenaed its conscience to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. We gained manhood in the nation that had always called us boy. For this, we can feel a legitimate pride. But, in spite of a decade of significant progress, the problem is far from solved. The deep rumbling of discontent in our cities is indicative of the fact that the plant of freedom has grown only a bud, and not yet a flower. And so, we still have a long, long way to go before we reach the promised land of freedom. Yes, we have left the dusty soils of Egypt, and we have crossed a Red Sea that had for years been hardened by a long and piercing winter of massive resistance. But before we reach the majestic shores of the Promised Land, there will still be gigantic mountains of opposition ahead and prodigious hilltops of injustice. We still need some Paul Revere of conscience to alert every hamlet and every village of America that revolution is still at hand. Yes, we need a chart. We need a compass. Indeed, we need some North Star to guide us into a future shrouded with impenetrable uncertainties. Now, let me rush on to say we must reaffirm our commitment to nonviolence. And I want to stress this. The futility of violence in the struggle for racial justice has been tragically etched in all the recent Negro riots. There is something painfully sad about a riot. One sees screaming youngsters and angry adults fighting hopelessly and aimlessly against impossible odds. And deep down within them, you perceive a desire for self-destruction, a kind of suicidal longing. Nowhere have the riots won any concrete improvement, such as have the organized protest demonstrations. And so I say to you today that I still stand by nonviolence. And I am still convinced that it is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for justice in this country. And the other thing is, I'm concerned about a better world. I'm concerned about justice. I'm concerned about brotherhood. I'm concerned about truth. And when one is concerned about that, he can never advocate violence. For through violence, you may murder a murderer, but you cannot murder murder. Through violence, you may murder a liar, but you can't establish truth. Through violence, you may murder a hater, but you can't murder hate through violence. Darkness cannot put out darkness. Only light can do that. And so, I conclude by saying today that we have a task, and let us go out with divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until those who live on the outskirts of hope are brought into the metropolis of daily security. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and even family will live in a decent, sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality, integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not on the basis of the color of their skin. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital will be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied until from every city hall, justice will roll down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and the human power. And I must confess, my friends, that the road ahead will not always be smooth. There will still be rocky places of frustration and meandering points of bewilderment. There will be inevitable setbacks here and there. Over there will be those moments when the buoyancy of hope will be transformed into the fatigue of despair. Our dreams will sometimes be shattered and our ethereal hopes blasted. We may again, with tear-drenched eyes, have to stand before the bier of some courageous civil rights worker whose life will be snuffed out by the dastardly acts of bloodthirsty mobs. When our days become dreary with low-hovering clouds of despair, and when our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, let us remember that there is a creative force in this universe working to pull down the gigantic mountains of evil, a power that is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Let us go out realizing that the Bible is right. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. This is our hope for the future, and with this faith, we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense, "We have overcome. We have overcome." Deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
Thank you for that reading of Dr. King's powerful words, Mike. And thanks to the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute of Stanford University for preserving the words of Dr. King. Dr. King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. At the time, he was the youngest Peace Prize laureate ever at the age of 35. Dr. King donated his prize money of $54,000 to the civil rights movement. His acceptance speech in Norway included his famous statement, "I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. That is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant." And now we'll wrap things up with Dr. King's own words included in this song by The Mood Swings.
"I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. This nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time. Satisfied, and we will not satisfied unto justice, down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. Now is the time. I still have a dream. So tonight I stand before you with a belief. I believe that the day can come right here in America. All of God's children will live together in progress. I believe there will be a day. Justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I believe somehow things can get better and dark yesterday can be transformed into bright tomorrow. I believe that the dignity and the worth of human personality will be respected one day. I believe it. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, he will be able to feed us that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last.